Look around this room this evening, I can tell immediately that we are all very different. Different genders, different ages, from different nations. I'm sure if we were to spend a bit more time and get to know one another a bit better around the tables, we'd also discover that we have different personalities and different persuasions, different passions. And yet, despite all of those differences, there is not a shadow of a doubt in my mind that in a very real sense, we are all the same. That we are all the same and equal in value and in dignity and in worth. There is no doubt in my mind as I look around and see each one of you that you are a person who has a right to be loved and to be known, to be cared for, and to be enabled to fulfill your potential in life. That you are a possessor of inherent dignity and worth as a member of the human family. Not a question in my mind about that. And so tonight we're asking this question, where do human rights come from? Where does that idea come from? That even though we're all so different, we're all the same. That we deserve to be treated the same as bearers of dignity and worth and value. You see, that is not an idea that has always been obvious to people in this world. It is not something that is self-evident. It is something that has had to be fought for across the centuries. You see, we live in a world where, as we've already thought, there are so many differences in aptitude, so many differences in ability. They're so obvious, they're in our face every single day. And that sometimes seems to be more obvious than the fact that we're all the same, that we're all equal. And so there's a tension. There are some people who really are smarter than others, some people who really are prettier than others, stronger than others, can run faster than others. So in what sense can we say that really we are different, but we are the same in value? There's a tension there. I want to tell you two quick stories from the headlines of the last few years that illustrate the tension. First one is I'd like to introduce you to Lord Jonathan Sumption. He was a former Supreme Court judge down in London. And a couple of years ago, he ignited a media firestorm with some comments that he made on the government COVID lockdown policy. He was being interviewed on the BBC Questions programme one Sunday, and he made this remarkable statement. He said, "All lives are not of equal value. The older you are, the less valuable yours is, because there's less of it left." He went on to argue that the lockdowns, they were unfair, because while it was older people who were more susceptible to the virus, it was younger people who were more disadvantaged and hurt by the consequences of lockdown. Lord Sumption didn't do himself any favours whenever a questioner phoned in, and she herself was someone who had spent the best part of a year of her life shielding. She was immunocompromised. And she complained to him, "How dare you say that my life is not of value?" And he just tried to defend himself as a lawyer, and he said, "Well, I didn't say that your life is not of no value, just that it is of less value." And for some reason, that just wasn't enough for this lady. But you know, you hear that, and you can understand why so many people were outraged, why they were offended at this suggestion that some people's lives are more valuable than others. That the younger you are, the healthier you are, the more worth your life is. Keep that in your mind for a minute as I move on and tell you another story. Let me introduce you to Heidi Crowther. This lady was in the headlines this past year when she took the government to court challenging the Abortion Act 1967. Under the terms of the Abortion Act, a woman has the right to request an abortion from her doctor up to 20 weeks, largely for almost any reason. But after that point, there are limitations. And Heidi is someone who has an additional chromosome in her genetic makeup. She has what we know as Down syndrome. And she was complaining that the Abortion Act says that a child in its mother's womb who has Down syndrome or another congenital disability can be terminated all the way up to birth. Any moment up to birth, that child in the mother's womb can be terminated. And Heidi was offended by this. She said, "This law makes me feel that I am not wanted and loved. It makes me feel not valued, that people don't want babies like me." She spoke up for many disabled people who felt discriminated against, stigmatized by the idea that someone can just choose to get rid of them up until birth when they can't do that for other children. Just back in November, Heidi lost her case in the court down in London. The court actually sympathized with her and said, "Yes, Heidi, you're you're absolutely entitled to actually feel put out by this, to feel offended by this. It does appear that your life is worth less than other people's. But your feelings are not enough to outweigh a woman's right to choose. And so she lost her case. For our first time around our tables, and there's still two tables here, if any of you at the back want to come and sit up and sit around and talk together, I want you to think back over what Jonathan Sumption said, what Heidi Kreuter says. I want you to think about how do their statements make you feel? And is there one in particular that you feel more drawn to that you agree with, and why? Take 5 minutes at your tables and chat about that. Well, if you wanted to draw your initial discussions to a close. We've set out our stall, two very different clashing opinions between Lord Jonathan Sumption and Heidi Kreuter. That takes us really to the heart of what we're thinking about tonight, our topic of the sanctity of human life. You know, it was only back in 1948 that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights declared for the first time that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. That was just declared in the wake of the Holocaust just years before in the Second World War. Now, it sounds good. I think we would probably all accept it and agree with it. But the question is why? How do we know that that is true? The UDHR doesn't tell us why this is true. It just asserts this as a matter of faith that you should just accept and believe. But why is this the case? You see, this is the dilemma we have as a Western society in these present times. We have these values about the equality, the dignity, the liberty, the sanctity of human life. We believe them to be true, but we don't know why. We don't have the foundations to support these beliefs that are so important to our everyday lives. At the very same time, we live in a world where we are faced by cultures in the majority world where they don't accept these things as being true, especially when it comes to the rights and the equality and the dignity of women. And so this is a very real problem that faces us in the 21st century. The question is, where do our values of human dignity, where do our beliefs in human rights come from? Are they simply things that we have invented in our heads? Or instead, are they things that we have discovered in the fabric of reality? These are two different answers that come from two very different stories that understand this question in two very different ways. I want to look at these two stories. I call them the human rights story and the God story. Very quickly, let's think about the human rights story. Scotland is known as the birthplace of the Enlightenment. Many of its leading thinkers and figures lived and worked here on the street outside the Royal Mile. And the heartbeat to the drive of the Enlightenment was to create a new society with laws and freedoms and rights that didn't depend upon any traditional authority or any kind of religious belief system. The Enlightenment believed that human reason alone, tools of human reason and science, were all that we needed to build such a society. But the problem when you start off like that, when you start off with a secular worldview, when you leave God out of the picture and you think we can work this all out ourselves with what we've got in here, the problem is that secular worldview ends up reducing human beings, not elevating human beings, but reducing human beings to being merely the products, the mindless products of time, chance, and natural selection. Someone who appreciates the implications of that secular belief system is the atheist professor Noah Yuval Harari. In his best-selling book, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humanity, he describes human beings in the first chapter as an animal of no significance. He goes on and explains in chapter 3, most legal systems in the world today are based on a belief in human rights. But what are human rights? Human rights, like God in heaven, are just a story that we've invented. Take a human being, cut him open, look inside, you'll find the heart, the kidneys, neurons, hormones, DNA, but you won't find any rights. The only place that you find rights is in the stories that we have invented and spread. Now, it might not warm your heart what Professor Harari says, but you cannot fault him for his ruthless intellectual consistency. In a world where there is no God, human beings like you and I, we have no greater purpose than survival and reproduction. And in such a world and in such a worldview, you will find it very, 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 very difficult to have foundations to support your beliefs in human dignity and equality and rights. That's not to say we haven't tried. We've spent the best part of 200-300 years as a Western world trying to do this unsuccessfully. Some unsuccessful attempts, let me just take you through them very quickly and simply. Some people have said, well, human beings, they're worthy of human rights and special consideration because they have special characteristics. That unlike the animals, human beings have other things about them that make us special, particularly the fact that we have rational minds, the ability to communicate. These are capacities that only human beings have, and that makes us special. That makes us worthy of special consideration. But the problem is when you go down that road, is you'll not only end up separating human beings from animals, but you'll also wind up separating some human beings from other human beings. What are you to do about people who are of lower than average intelligence? What do you do with those who are mentally handicapped? Are they not worthy of special consideration and protection and rights? That's the dilemma. Another possibility that the thinkers have tried is that the state gives human beings human rights. People imagine back to the very first societies, whenever people got together to form the first human communities, and they imagine that people before that were free. But they decided to band together, club together, and they surrendered their power to the state, and the state in turn granted them human rights and protections. But the great problem, if you go down that road, is that if a past human government has given us rights, what is to stop a future government deciding to take away the rights of a minority group in our society? And if the majority think that's a great idea, they would actually like to enslave this group over here, well, then what's to stop them? The state gives and the state takes away. It's not impossible to imagine. It's what happened in Europe in the last century, in Germany. And then there's a third possibility. That is that just human rights, human values, it's just self-existent. It just exists. That just as there are scientific truths out there in the material world, so increasingly there are thinkers saying that there are these moral truths. Just as there are mathematical truths like 2 plus 2 equals 4, it just exists. That's just the way it is. Tough, you don't like it. 2 plus 2 equals 4, it equals 4 in all universes. It's just a fact. Just as there are truths like that, there are also moral truths. That human beings are valuable because they're valuable, because they're valuable, and that's just the way it is. You just have to accept it. Because we can't live unless it's true. We can't live well unless that's a fact. Well, I would actually suggest that we can actually do better than that. I think that what makes far better sense of the fact that we live in a universe of physical laws that makes science possible, the fact that we live in a universe where there are mathematical laws that work and allow us to do science, the fact that we live in a universe of moral laws, things that we know, values and deep convictions that we possess about justice and equality, the fact these laws exist is evidence of there being a divine lawgiver who put them there in the first place. And so that takes us from the human rights story onto the God story. And it might surprise you to discover that the foundation of human rights and human dignity and human equality, it's religious in origin. It has grown up in a particular soil, the soil of Christianity. You don't have to be a Christian to accept that that's true. The secular historian Tom Holland in his book Dominion writes that every human being possessed an equal dignity was not remotely self-evident a truth. The origins of this principle lay in the Bible. Even our friend, the atheist professor Noah Yuval Harari, who we mentioned a few minutes ago, he agrees as well. He writes, "The liberal belief in the free and sacred nature of each individual is a direct legacy of the traditional Christian belief in free and eternal souls." You may not be a Christian here tonight, but you certainly believe Christian things if you think that people are worthy of value and are equal. That's what you discover when you open up the very first page of the Bible. On the very first page of the Bible, we read, Then God said, let us make mankind in our image, after our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the air, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. The Bible here is celebrating that the crowning glory of all of God's creation, it's not the mighty mountains, it's not the stars and the nebulae and the constellations, it's you and me, it's human beings made in the image and likeness of God. People with rational minds and free wills, people with incredible curiosity, with incredible imaginations, everyone with incredible potential. That is the crowning glory of God's masterpiece of creation, human beings. The Bible tells us that we are never just matter, timeless, mindless matter. Well, the Bible tells us that we matter because we have a maker who loves us and values us. So to summarize just what we've thought about so far, Christian thinker Glenn Scrivener writes, the God story and the human rights story are connected. Without a God story, and without a very particular God story, he means Christianity, humans remain adrift in the world, fending for themselves and valued for their properties only, some valued more and some much less. What I'd like you to do now in your groups, there's two questions going to come on the screen. First one is, are you surprised to hear and learn this, that the things that you believe about human value and equality, that they actually come from the Bible? Is that a surprise to you? Be honest. And I think this is, I forgot to change the second question, so I'll need to change the second one. The second question is, have you ever thought about how the God story and your story connect? Your origins, your meaning, your destiny. Have you ever thought how the God story and your story connect? I'll change the second one. Over to you for 5 minutes. draw your conversations to a close. I want to particularly just draw and pick up on that thread of thinking about how does the God story connect with your story, our story as human beings? There's no better place, I think, to answer that and to think more about that than to go back to the passage that Stephen read to us earlier from the Bible, from a true story taken from the historical account of the life of Jesus Christ. You see, God has come into this world. God's not just up in heaven. God has come into this world as a human being called Jesus Christ. And when you look at Jesus, you see God in action. And you see when you read the life of Jesus, you see him interacting with all sorts of people, how he takes marginalized people and makes them the center of his attention, how he treats nobodies as if they're somebody because they are somebody to him. He touches the untouchables. He defends the powerless. He speaks up for the voiceless. Every single person who Jesus Christ ever met on this earth, he treated with honor and dignity and compassion. And in this story in Mark chapter 5, we meet two women, two very different women at that. One is a 12-year-old girl. She's dying. The other is an older lady who for 12 years has been suffering. She has an incurable illness that has ruined her life and has caused her to be ostracized onto the margins of her community. Now, this child, starting with her, she's the daughter of a VIP in town called Jairus. Jairus is a pretty important figure. And Jairus, at this moment as the story kicks off, he is rushing with Jesus, trying to get Jesus back to his house as fast as possible. He almost wishes that they invented the blue lights and sirens because he just wants to get Jesus home as fast as possible because his daughter's dying and he needs Jesus to do something to save his daughter before it's too late. The problem is that in ancient Israel, the streets are narrow and they're busy. They're packed with people, especially at this time of the day. They're just absolutely packed. And so it's so, so difficult to squeeze through the crowds to get Jesus from the marketplace to Jairus' house. And there in that busy street, in that crowd, there is the second lady, the lady who has been unwell for 12 years. People feared that they would get sick if she was near them, and so she's been ostracized, pushed out of the community. She lives on the margins. And after 12 years of being rejected by people and suffering, rejected by our family, by our friends, by everybody, she doesn't think very much of herself anymore. She's beat down. She's low self-esteem, what you would say. And she's heard the stories about Jesus, that Jesus does things that no mere man can do, that he is able to make sick people well again. And she desperately wants to be made well again. And so she sees her opportunity. Jesus is passing by. She doesn't think that Jesus would have time for her. Nobody's got time for her. So she just anonymously reaches out quietly her hand in the middle of the busy, packed street and just touches the hem of Jesus' garment. For 12 years, she had seen every doctor that there was available. She had tried every treatment on the market. Nothing worked. In that one moment, touching Jesus' garment, she was healed. In that very same moment, Jesus stopped. Stopped right in his tracks and said, "Who touched me?" If you were in her shoes, what would you be thinking in that moment? You'd be pretty scared, wouldn't you? Think, "Oh, I've done something wrong. I'm really in trouble now, aren't I? This big guy, he's coming. He is going to be so angry at me." "It's me, Jesus. It was me. I touched your garment." Jesus tells her in the hearing of everyone in town. Doesn't scold her. He says, "Daughter, your faith has healed you." Now, Jesus didn't have to stop and talk to this lady. He did need to be somewhere else at that very moment. But he deliberately stops and makes contact, human contact with this woman, because that's what she's lacked for 12 years. Jesus wants her to know that God in heaven is her heavenly Father and that she is his daughter. And he loves her and cares for her and values her. And far from embarrassing her in the sight of everyone in town by making her step forward and reveal herself, by announcing that she is well, Jesus has actually just made it possible for her to be readmitted into the community. He's removed the social stigma around her she's now clean, she's now safe. She can be brought back into our friendship and family circles. And so we see in just this little encounter how Jesus sees this woman and treats this woman with incredible dignity and transforms her life physically, socially, spiritually. It's incredible. Again, for a few minutes, just at your tables, here's a question to reflect and talk about. To what extent can you see something of your experiences, your own heart of feeling rejected or being disrespected by people? How much do you see something of yourself in your own experiences in this lady and her story? Over to you. Your conversations again. I think all of us have some experience with rejection, don't we? Or at least, if we haven't faced it outright, we have spent our lives doing everything possible to avoid it. We fear it. This lady knows all about it. And isn't it just amazing to see how Jesus relates to her? And I think that we all of us then can see that if that's how Jesus relates to her, we can catch a glimpse of how Jesus sees us and how Jesus wants to relate with us in her story. But meanwhile, don't forget, Jairus is over here. He's watching all this happen, and he's tapping his feet on the ground. If he had a watch, he'd be looking at it, going, "Come on, Jesus, we need to get back to my house as soon as possible." Sadly, while all this is happening, one of his employees comes from his house bearing this bad news, saying, "Your daughter is dead. Don't bother the rabbi anymore." Just the trap door is opened in Jairus' world. He's just collapsed. Absolute worst nightmares come true. He believed that Jesus would be able to help his daughter if only he could get there before she died. But Jesus is about to show Jairus that he can still help after she has died. He reaches out his hand. Jesus touches Jairus and he says, "Don't be afraid. Just believe and she will be healed." And so they head off through the busy streets to Jairus' house. When they arrive, the mourners are all gathered. Jesus asks to be taken upstairs to the little girl's bedroom. They go in and they see her little, pale, lifeless, limp body lying on the bed. She's very much dead. But then Jesus goes over and he takes her hand. And it's as if he reaches down into death and lifts her back out again. He says to her, "My child, get up." It's almost like he's just trying to wake up a sleeping teenager. "Come on, wake up, get up, come on." But she's dead. But to Jesus, death is just like sleep. And he is able to raise this little girl back to life. Her heart starts beating again. She gasps for breath. The color returns to her face. She sits up. She's alive. And then Jesus, again, paying attention to the wider needs that she has in her life, says, "Go and bring her something to eat. She'll be hungry. She's get her strength back." And so you see in this story, Mark chapter 5, Jesus interacting with these two women, two very different women. And you see the incredible dignity and love and compassion which he shows them. But there is something more that's even far more significant than that going on in this story. Because Mark has chosen these two incidents because he wants to show us that Jesus has just saved these people from the two greatest enemies that afflict the human race, the world over. The two greatest enemies to human welfare and well-being, their sickness and their death. And Jesus can do something about them because Jesus has come to deal with the root problem of which sickness and death are just the symptom. You see, the Bible tells us that God created a good world. He made human beings in his image, in his likeness. That's the way he made the world to be. But the world in which we live today is not the way that God intended it to be, because we, human beings, are not the way that God intended us to be. God gave us the ability to live for him and to enjoy him. But we chose instead to live for ourselves. And rather than result in heaven on earth, it's just unleashed hell on earth. We're like Christmas trees. We've been chopped down. We've been cut off from our roots. We get dressed up now for a while, but we're slowly fading. We're slowly dying. We're losing our needles, our good looks. Never had them in the first place, but some of you. And one day they're going to throw us out in the rubbish heap of history. place the Bible calls hell. The Bible says that we all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, that although we have been made in the image of God, we have this glorious, glorious status filled with potential. We have not lived up to it. Instead, we have descended, turned our backs on God and descended into sin, disobedience, rebellion against God. And the wages of sin is death. It's the reason why we get sick. It's the reason why we die. But Jesus has come to deal with sin. Through these saving these women, one who's sick, one who's dead, shows that he's come to deal ultimately with sin. He didn't just come to reform human society. He didn't come just to champion human rights. He came to reconcile sinful humanity with God as Father, to reconnect the cut down Christmas trees with their roots. But for that reconciliation to take place, something has to be done about the sin that's within. Something has to be done with the problem of all the evil and all the selfishness that's within us. And that's what the cross is all about. For God in the person of his Son, Jesus, takes upon himself the sin and the shame and the guilt and the regrets of all the world. And he suffers for it in our place. He dies for us to make an end of it once and for all, so that we might instead be brought back to God, reconciled with him as our Heavenly Father, that we might be reunited with his life that not even death can defeat. It's not just wishful thinking, it's not just positive thinking. Jesus not just died on the cross 3 days later, history records that he rose again from the dead, vindicating his claims that he is the one who can deal with sin, the one who can conquer sickness, and the one who can ultimately defeat death and your death. That's the good news that Jesus offers to this world. Jesus shows us through all of these things that in God's eyes, you and I are not just mindless, meaningless matter. No, we matter. We're loved. We're valued in God's sight. And that's good news. For one final time this evening, I'd like you to just turn to those around you and talk about these two questions on the screen. And the first one is, what do you think about Jesus from what you've heard from this story tonight? I wonder, are there any other questions that you feel that you need to have answered and figured out to understand fully who Jesus is? Over to you for another 5 minutes. Well, the time is running away from us, and we're going to have to start pulling things towards a conclusion tonight, but don't rush away. There'll still be time to spend talking about these things around your tables afterwards. Let me just summarize where we've come to tonight. Tonight we've been thinking about, what is it that makes human beings special? What makes it that we are worthy of human rights? And the answer from the Bible is that it's because we're special in God's sight, that he has given us these things as a gift, that he has honored us by becoming one of us in the person of Jesus Christ, his Son, that Jesus has shown us the incredible value that he places upon us in the lengths that he's gone to death and back to save us from our greatest enemies, sin and death and hell. And that God promises us that he loves us and has a plan and a purpose for us. If only we would let him into our lives, let him sit at the steering wheel, give him the keys, and he will lead us and direct us right through life and help us to make sense of what otherwise often doesn't make sense. Jesus shows us that we are never just meaningless matter. No, Jesus shows us that we matter to God, that we are valued in his sight. We're loved by him. But that leaves us with, each one of us with a question tonight to go away with and to ponder. The truth is that you matter to God. The question for you is, does Jesus matter to you? Is Jesus included in the picture, your picture, as you seek to make sense of your life? Ponder that a wee bit. The house band are going to come and they're going to perform for us again, singing a song all about Jesus, all about the things he's done for us because he loves us and values us.